Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora, Bookends listeners, and welcome to another week with our show about Aotearoa Puka Puka. This morning, unfortunately, you just get me for the intro, but we are in safe hands for a discussion with Anna Jackson, who talks with Morin about Te Whariki, reading 10 new poets. That will be a wonderful discussion, and Morin bags us all the poetry. And I then am going to be talking with Peter Carey about the remarkable history of New Zealand's venison and live extraction industry through the 70s and 80s from Te Anau. It's called The Hollows Boys, and it is a gripping yarn. And then I'm still in the wild, New Zealand's wild places, with Emily and Victoria Bruce talking about Emily, the nine-year-old's wonderful story, Emily Walks Te Araroa Travel. So lots of wild at heart and wild Aotearoa to enjoy this morning. Here we go.
For anyone who is intrigued, exhilarated, or maybe just a little confused and baffled by contemporary New Zealand poetry, then this new publication, Te Whariki, Reading 10 New Poets from Aotearoa, is for them. It's been edited by Anna Jackson, Dougal McNeil and Robert Sullivan, and it offers a thorough and thoughtful introduction to the liveliness and diversity of some of our best and some of our newest poets. Anna is with me. Anna is a poet herself, of course. Her latest book is Terrier Warrior, which I hope we can talk about at the end. And she is Associate Professor in English Literature at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. Anna, first of all, the title. Just tell us how you came to that title and what it means.
Yeah, thank you for asking about the title, because it does mean a lot to us, really. The whole kaupapa of the book is there present in the title. So a whariki is a fine mat made by a community of weavers. It's a skill set that's intergenerational, and it's a whariki has to be woven with many strands and is woven by many makers. and that's our sense of the way poetry is being made, and the project of reading poetry as well in Aotearoa today, that this is... It's a real kind of community-making venture where every strand is the voice of a single poet, but together we're weaving something larger and more beautiful than what anyone could do alone.
And I'm guessing the kaupapa behind it was part of what drew you to this idea, you and the other editors, and how you worked together to decide how to put structure the book and choose the poets, choose the reviewers, the choose the people who were going to write their critiques.
Yeah, it was a beautifully collaborative project. Between the three of us talking about sense of New Zealand poetry today and what we wanted to convey and who we wanted to be involved. But then also putting the book together, it was just kind of a series of invitations that we throw out to poets to be involved and essays to write about them. And then we get these gifts back of the poets writing their poet statements and essays excited to be involved and suggesting poets that they would want to write about.
I think that comes across because there is, you know, we are being introduced or reintroduced to poets that we may be familiar with or not. But there is a sense of excitement in this book of the freshness and vivacity of the works, the how they present themselves in this new digital age. I just so enjoyed the opportunity to read the essays as well, because that's a whole nother area of work around poetry that a lot of people don't get to see or be exposed to.
Yeah, and there's such a pleasure in writing the essays too. So I wrote one of the essays, and each of the essays really welcomed the opportunity to sit down with the work of a poet and just spend time working out for ourselves what it is that is so exciting about this work that makes us want to keep returning to it, that makes us want to sit and read it line by line and work out what we want to say. They're all, every poet in this book is a poet that the essayist wanted to spend time reading and rereading and had been reading and rereading and can't get enough of, and then what you want to do is convey that sense to a reader of what is so inexhaustible about this poetry.
And we need to learn how to read poetry, those of us who don't write it. I think it's an ongoing thing. You could never say that you had finished or knew how to do it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there's two ways really into that finding how you read poetry. You know, if you're more used to reading narrative, if you read narrative nonfiction or you read fiction, a poem's doing something a little bit different. It's over almost before you started it. You know, how do you immerse yourself in it? It works differently. It immerses itself in you in a way. You can remember a whole poem in the way you can't remember a whole novel. You can learn it off by heart. You can find lines keep returning to you. You'll want to, like a song that you want to hear over and over, a poem that has really taken you, that you've taken to, you're going to want to read over and over and more than once. And so the anthology offers two things. It includes poems by each of the poets that we write about so that you can return to their poems yourself. And if you love them, you'll want to be looking out for the whole collection. You can also read them really quickly. You know, I think a poem, you can catch something from a poem with a quick reading. You don't have to invest time in it. You can read across a range of poems, and there'll be one maybe that you want to keep coming to out of all those poems, and that's okay. That's how I read. It's how it should be. But the essays also give you a chance to sit down and spend a little bit more time with the poems through someone else's reading that you'll then want to compare with your own reading. But just having, I think, someone say, look at this line, what it's doing, or look at how this concern is expressed in this way and then it's picked up in this poem in this way, and then look, they're doing this here in this other poem that takes us right back to that poem we read at the start, can just be a way of holding you in that moment of reading a poem for a little longer, if a poem might seem to be over too quickly.
Yes, I enjoyed that about the essays, absolutely. And, you know, I did know some of the poets work quite well, somebody like Claudia Hertz-Jardine, yeah. who's on our on our program frequently. Yeah. I know her work. Tae Tibble, of course, I'm familiar with, and Nafanua Purcell-Kersell. I interviewed her earlier this year, so I had time to spend with her poems. There's a really good variety of poems here, but the other thing is, you know, what makes contemporary poetry stand out is how diverse the poems look on the page now.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is really exciting about the contemporary poetry being written today in Aotearoa, and the constant experimentation and playing around with what you can do with form, how a poem can look, how that changes how you hear it with you, whether it affects how it's read out loud or whether you can kind of have it, the look on the page can be at cross currents with how you read the syntax too, in ways that can be quite exciting for the eye. people always say, you know, you have to hear poetry, you have to hear poetry, and there's truth to that, but there's also a real interest in playing with those kind of reading effects where you're having to keep up with what your eye is doing.
Yes.
There's a kind of energy in that that can be very exciting and can just be playful as well.
Yes, it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be of great significance. Maybe, as you say, maybe just whimsy on the page.
Yeah.
I also, you know, along with the poems, the author statements are really useful too, aren't they?
Yeah.
Giving us an indication of how these poets approach poetry. And a lot of, there's so much performance poetry out there now that, as you say, a lot of people are writing to be heard rather than to be seen.
Yeah, I love the poet statements. They're like little poems in themselves. That was one of the really fun things about compiling the book, was asking the poets for poet statements and the difference in the ways they approached it. Like, some poets were like, oh yeah, here you go, how's this? And 10 minutes later, you know, there's the poet statement, and it's just perfect. It's got such fresh energy that, you know, you just, well, yeah, we're just putting it in just like that. Other poets sort of working away and submitting drafts and asking questions and wanting to see models and working on it for months. And, you know, in the way that poets work on their poems so very differently. They're always so many surprising ways of thinking about how poetry works in every one of those poet statements. Like, I really love the way Oscar Upperton talked about the rhyme in his poetry as being kind of like a stealthy exclamation mark. if you don't want to use too many exclamation marks, you can just put in some rhymes and it will have the same effect. And I've been thinking about that ever since, because it kind of makes no sense, but it kind of does. It kind of makes perfect sense. It's another form of emphasis. But to think of the rhyme as an exclamation mark, like in stealth, is just kind of brilliant.
The book is full of those moments.
About, you know, when you're talking about the excitement of the poet Claudia Jardine and her poet statement talks about putting her collection together. I think she says in a state of rabid frenzy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Love can, produce all sorts of effects. And in her case, a collection of poetry. Just to finish, Anna, talking about doing slightly different things, your latest collection, Terrier Warrior, is a poem in five parts. And I must say, it's a collection that I've been back to numerous times because it really provokes thought, but not in a heavy, didactic way.
Well, that's exactly what I would hope. that it's, it's a collection of thoughts in itself, but if the thoughts can prompt further thoughts. I mean, they're thoughts of mine that are prompted, often by writers that I'm reading or conversations that I'm having. And, it's how thought works.
It is. Exactly.
Read a thought and then you think a thought.
It's a very simple proposition, but it just, I was really taken by how it did exactly what it says it's doing, which is to provoke many thoughts and make you rethink and think again and reconsider what's going on in your head. But it's all done in a seemingly lighthearted way, where you're looking at domestic things, at conversations with people, at how your life is ticking over. But there's that brain just constantly thinking thoughts.
I think having this space is, so thinking about, you call it propositions, and I think, that's perfect. It's a whole lot of propositions, which makes me think of Wittgenstein's propositions that I always read as poetry rather than philosophy, partly because of that's the way I read. But it's the spaces between two, isn't it? That, I mean, even, Wittgenstein's propositions, they're so small. and these are small thoughts with space between them to open up the space for readers to think their own thoughts and to make what connections you want to make between different images, different ideas.
Well, you've done it spectacularly well, Anna. So, I think a copy of Terrier Warrior should be in everybody's Christmas stocking this year.
Well, I hope everyone will write their own Terrier Warriors.
Yeah. I think so.
It's trying to make sense that,
I think you will provoke that. So, thank you for your time. Thank you for your energy. Thank you. And your fellow editors for putting together Te Whariki, reading 10 new poets from Aotearoa, Anna Jackson, Dougal McNeil, Robert Sullivan are the editors, and look out for Terrier Warrior, a poem in five parts by Anna Jackson. And both these books have been beautifully published by Auckland University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Peter Carey is an acclaimed author and documentary maker whose constant muse has been Fiordland and the deep southwest of Aotearoa. The Hollows Boys is her fourth book and plunges the reader into the adrenaline-charged lives and world of three brothers whose intertwined stories are writ large over the era of venison and live deer capture in Fiordland in the 70s and 80s. Peter has known two of the brothers for many years, is herself deeply connected to the place and the community documented in this remarkable book, and she joins me on Zoom this morning. Tēnā koe, Peter. Thanks very much for chatting to us on Bookends.
Oh, kia ora, Mary-Anne, and lovely to be here. Thank you.
So, Peter, I'm really not sure where to start with this book. So just for readers, it's a story of a community in an era, but to find your way into it and share it with us, you've had access to and have captured so many different perspectives, right? You've interviewed so many people. That feels like it reflects a real depth of connection on your part. And so your own history with this place and these people, tell us all about that.
Well, it goes all the way back to the early 80s when I first stepped foot in Fiordland and I met someone who I would later, I would be together with in my late teens. I would leave and then I would come back, but I never lost a connection with Fiordland. And I suppose right there and then at the age of sweet 17, Marianne, I was introduced to the venison industry, the helicopter recovery venison industry more precisely. And I just accepted it and met a lot of the characters back then. And when I came back into the area, it was probably about 2000, the year 2000. And as a writer, I just, because of, by dint of geography, I keep getting kind of tugged back into Fiordland. The overwhelming feeling for me always was, this has always been, I mean, it is an extraordinary era and you have to put an underline under the word extraordinary. There is nothing in the world that has ever, ever equaled the New Zealand helicopter venison recovery and industry. And it is, has it ever properly been documented? There have been a lot of writers who have done the odd biography, Bill Black, Dick Deaker, you name it, and it's always been a story of gung-ho, boy's own adventure. And I suppose I was more drawn to it from... I wouldn't use woman's point of view in the pejorative sense, but an insight into that world, having got to know a lot of the characters, perhaps they open up to a woman more. Mm. You know, I've seen the hardest pilots show tears. I've heard the stories from how the trauma has landed on their shoulders and they have carried it through life. I mean, there are two sides of it. One is the aviation side of it. You know, I'm a nutter for planes. I've never quite understood a helicopter, but I think helicopters are amazing, absolutely astonishing pieces of engineering.
Sure.
And there's a dance that these guys do in the sky, which you have to absolutely marvel at. The second thing is, you know, it takes place in the most beautiful place in the world, which is Fiordland National Park. And the third thing is the human story. And I suppose throughout my life, I'm always led into areas that I want to document for the sake of heritage.
Sure.
If nothing else, that's why I did it.
Sure. Yeah. Because it is that. It is, it's a history. And in so much as it's a biography, it's not actually uniquely the boy's story at all that you're telling, are you? They're a vehicle for the era.
They're a vehicle. And I think what's often missed is that everybody just thinks it's Mark and Kim's story with Gary thrown in for a bit of, you know, tragedy, dare I say it. This is a story of an entire community.
Oh, my goodness.
If I was standing in a room, I would go, Dick Deaker, thank you. Hannibal, Sir Richard Hayes, thank you. Sam Shaw, Craig Fever, Noddy, Sid Deaker, you know, acknowledge you all and families.
And
you know,
families.
This is very much the story of the community. Yeah.
One thing that you said there in your first response to me was you said from a woman's perspective, and it's kind of wry, isn't it? Because you know, there's the women aren't the main characters here in this era, in this narrative. It's, we're inside an era defined by men's friendships, adrenaline, you know, it's a men's industry. There's not a single woman pilot or shooter or hunter anywhere that I come across until we're in the venison era, until we meet Jane in the story, who flies helicopters. But, you know, so it's a men's story. And yet, really interestingly, I heard the women's voices in it and recognised the women and found that I felt what the women's lives were in all of this as really strongly. It comes through strongly in the book. And so well done for that. But that's quite an achievement when you're talking about such a masculine thing.
I don't think I actually put too much emphasis on the women's side of the story. And I did that expressly, Marianne, because, you know, other commentators, Paul Roy did a great podcast series. And I just have to say, I started this book several years ago.
Right.
Paul Roy podcast series, you know, gave a voice to a lot of the women. I didn't need to do that again.
But, they're there.
They're there. They have a shit time, particularly with these boys.
Yeah. Sure.
I mean, you know, not every pilot treated their wives the way the Hollows boys did. But I was conscious that it's always up to the women to feel things, up to the women to be the ones who worried. Actually, it's the blokes as well.
Yeah.
You know,
let's
be honest.
Yeah, for sure. And so it is very much a book about men's grief, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things that I kind of struck me was whether you, obviously you knew these two men's stories and you knew this era, you understood how much loss there was, but did you quite understand when you were setting out to write it the weight that that grief would give the book? Because it is... It feels to me like the book is hugely a book about men's grief, where you kind of see men grieving and feeling in a way, and hard men grieving and feeling in a way that defines what the book is all about.
I wouldn't put too much weight on that, Marianne. I think it's a corollary of the industry. I think the book is about that, but it's also a record of what was involved. Extraordinary skill that they had to develop in a very short space of time. But the other big thing the book is about, is about luck. They wouldn't have been able to have become such skilled pilots had they not been lucky to get through so many near misses. From each one, they learned those skills. Yeah.
Sure.
I think luck is the overriding theme of this book, actually.
Is it?
And what is luck?
Okay, and what is luck? So you do write about that, and it comes through again and again in their reflections. I was lucky. Having just survived something really big and horrendous, I was lucky. You know, lost people, I was lucky. And so it is a remarkable theme in the book. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that, about what luck came to mean to you, how you came to understood it through writing the book?
You know, I think it's a really interesting kind of concept that applies to us all. What is luck? Is luck just a roll of the dice, or is there some reason why one person survives and not another? But equally, are you lucky just to survive? You know, I don't think Mark's lucky to carry the burden of what he witnessed that happened to his own brother at his own hands.
Mm.
You know, that's not lucky.
And yet. He does survive and make life, and after that, and to this day, have, you know, an ongoing friendship with his brother, and, you know, what. So it's a big burden to carry, but there's a lot that comes after. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's for every individual reader to think about that whole concept, luck versus fate versus... Or just any interpretation of, you know, is luck purely survival?
Yeah.
But does it equate purely with survival? Not necessarily.
Yeah, so the industry itself is extraordinary. Live deer capture and venison hunting, both. Probably equally difficult kind of technically in that landscape. I mean, for the You know, it sounds like a ridiculously difficult technically thing to do, and the landscape through it all. People who've written about that industry before, there's been the story of kind of gung-ho. The other thing, you know, it's known as the Deer Wars. And so one of the things that I think about it is I've always heard it as a story of intense competition. And you don't focus on that. You focus on connection rather than competition.
There is a bit in the book about competition.
It's a bit there, but it's not the focus. Yeah. It doesn't feel like, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, equally though, just for the listeners, the Deer Wars is a term that's actually applied generally across the venison recovery industry era, but it actually pertains only to a very finite, very definite period in the 70s when there was no kind of licensing, there was no organisation from the Parks Department, and it was carte blanche. Everybody could do what they liked.
Yeah.
And that was officially the Deer Wars.
Right. And so that's the very early, well, once the boys are in situ down there, that's the early part of our story here for these boys. We get some of that then. Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kim, to be honest with you, came in on the end of that period. Mm. But the competition aspect of it, that's very much there. And I think it actually does take place through the book, principally through the relationship between the brothers. You know, Kim is always the one who excels, who has to excel. Mm. He has to get more deer than anyone else. And, you know, Mark is constantly in Kim's kind of shadow, I suppose. Mm. And I suppose you could ask yourself, well, how did that affect Mark? And how did that affect others in the industry? But particularly, how did that affect Mark? Did it push him that little bit harder?
Mm.
Was he prey to that?
Yeah. So that particular competition, that narrative of brothers, the, you know, like brothers shaping each other, that's a much bigger bigger historical story, isn't it? I mean, every Cain and Abel, I mean, every story is that's about brothers has got elements of that. What's interesting to me is this kind of the golden Goggy, you know, and Gary, this character who's so much older, who is the reason that they're both drawn down there, and who shapes both boys, but there's nothing competitive really in that.
Gary was the one who would never have counted how many deer he got.
Yeah, right, yeah. So,
you know, for him it was just being out there.
Being
he
in the wild.
Being out there.
Mm. And he was more of a ground guy anyway, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But
I mean, that was the cruel irony. You know, Gary loved actually just hunting on the ground.
Sure, sure. The extent of grief, though, I know you say it wasn't for you the main theme, but just the notes at the end, killed in an accident, took his own life. Every chapter almost has got these notes of the people that you've been talking about in this chapter and their sad ends, you know. And there's so much grief and so much cumulative grief that these communities, but particularly these men, are expressing. For me, it certainly did feel like that was one of the things, to see real hard men and hear them in their own voices, which you capture really well, talking about.
I got an email the other day, Marianne, from the owner of a local magazine, actually, and he thanked me for writing the book because he wanted his 18-year-old son to read it.
Right.
To show him that there is a cost associated with this kind of all in, you know, hell for leather, kind of adrenaline charged macho that might appear as some kind of attraction that might attract young men.
Yeah.
He wanted his son to realise that there was a cost associated with it.
And
he thanked me for the very first time I'd actually written about that cost.
Yeah, written about the cost. And you do feel the cost in the book. I think the cost gives the book its weight, its import, if you like. And I was chatting with a friend, and we reflected that people could buy this book thinking, oh, I know somebody who's an adventuresome fellow, you know, there's not too many books for men about, you know, so I'll buy this book for my, and but reading it, men are going to come to grips with that, the cost of masculinity, and, you know, and that life. So,
one of the things I'm, you know, some writers might want your top critic to send you a good review. The best review for me is a bloke in the central North Island I've never met.
Sure.
He probably never reads books. He read my book. Not only that, he went online, he found an email address for me. He sent me a message, barely literate, wow, telling him how much it had affected him.
Wow.
The fact that blokes all over New Zealand are picking up a book and reading it.
Beautiful.
And that it's affecting them.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. Or their wives telling me, so-and-so never reads a book. Oh, my God, he sat down, he couldn't stop reading it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a wonderful legacy, and I'm glad that you are feeling proud about that. There's one thing that struck me in it, and it's the attraction to young people. So when you just mentioned your mate's 17-year-old son that he was hoping to read it to seeing the cost, the children in this, you know, Gog's children, Mark's kids. And they, even despite the kind of dysfunctional, the instability, the insecurity of this life and the tensions in it, the children all want to be in Te Anau in the glow of it all. Can you tell me what that alchemy is about? How come there's this fundamental appeal for the young people to go back?
I mean, I wouldn't say they all want to go back to Te Anau, but... But, you know, Mark and Kim are fun people to be around.
Yeah.
Particularly Mark. Mark's lovely. You know, people always refer to Mark as Uncle Mark, and he is a bit of a teddy bear, and he's lovely to be around.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed my time talking to Mark. You know, he was welcoming, he was kind, but he's also so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand why the kids want to be around their fathers.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Be around your fathers. And there is that. I mean, because these men, even though they are archetypal 70s men, drinking, living large, adrenaline charged, they're also loving people, aren't they? They're loving, you know, there's more to them than just that archetypal 70s blokedom.
I'm not going to comment
not
on that.
Not going to comment. More came through.
Not one of their ex-wives.
Yeah, not one of their ex-wives. Fair enough. Look, more came through in the book. People are complex. Times and eras are complex. Peter has done a beautiful job of capturing it. The book capturing, in fact, from the publisher's notes, what happens when the wild comes home. The book is The Hollows Boys. It's by Peter Carey, and it's published in a beautiful publication with lots of rare photos, matte finish. It's a gorgeous book by Cotton and Burton.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Tēnei ata e kororo ana au ki Emily Bruce rāua ko tōna māma, Victoria. Together, Emily and her mum walked Aotearoa's to Araroa Trail. That's a through walk the length of both islands, from Cape Reinga to Bluff. It's an adventure that both mother and daughter have chronicled. Victoria's book, Adventures with Emily, is an acclaimed memoir, largely about the power of walking, particularly as women, for healing ourselves and facing our futures with strength. Emily's book, the subject of our kōrero tēnei ata, is written and illustrated for an audience of middle readers, aged 5 to 12-ish. There are no big past ghosts to battle here for Emily. It's a book that captures simply the spirit of a big, hard walking adventure from a plucky, happy kid's perspective, and it's utterly charming. Tēnā kōrua, Victoria and Emily. Welcome to Bookends.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us. Happy to be here.
Cool. Emily, I think you have prepared a little bit of a reading for us just to get us into the spirit of walking to Araroa from your perspective. Do you want to lead in with a bit of a reading?
Of course. This reading is called The Magic of the Mountains. The Magic of the Mountains. Even though Mum and I spent lots of time alone in the mountains, I was never lonely. Because when you walk in nature, you're never truly alone. You just need to stop and listen. At first, all you hear is your own footsteps and the wind in the trees. But if you wait, the forest starts to whisper its secrets. Tiny creatures rustle in the undergrowth. A piwaka waka flits from branch to branch, chattering like an old friend. A tomtit watches from a twig, tilting its head like it's trying to share an important secret. Mum and I love talking to the birds. We make up voices for them and imagine their tiny bird dramas. "Oh no, Gerald, you twit. You built your nest in the wrong tree again," Mum would say in a posh voice, and I'd burst into laughter, the kind that made my tummy hurt. But Mum didn't just see birds. She saw magic everywhere. She noticed the way morning dew made a spider's web sparkle like a necklace, and how sunlight turned moss into a glowing green carpet. "Maybe the forest fairies are hanging out their pearls to dry," she'd say, her eyes twinkling. And just like that, I could see them too. Tiny, fluttering fairies hiding among the trees. Some stretched out baby fern fronds like rolled up scrolls. Other painted pink streaks on horopito leaves. A pair washed their silky hair in a waterfall, while another group stitched skirts from flower petals. We walked for hours, spinning stories about the magic of the forest, and I never once felt alone.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for that. That's a lovely extract. I enjoyed reading that extract myself when I did, so it's a lovely one that you chose. Thank you. You're off on another adventure at the moment, it looks like to me. You're parked up in your caravan. Tell me about where you are right now.
So right now we are in Lake Hauea Village. We are outside Lake Hauea, and we're going down to Wanaka today, do some book talks, and then another one in Queenstown. And then we're going to go to some huts like Brewster Hut and some others, and go do some hut bagging while we're enjoying the time down here.
Cool. So you're still on your hut bagging adventure. How many have you bagged by now?
I have now bagged 443.
Woohoo. Is that some kind of age specific like record? Do you know? Is there such a thing? Have you looked anywhere to find out what other 9-year-old girls' records might be for hut bagging?
I am the top of the under 18 category on the hut bagger website.
Fantastic. And Emily, just tell me your age right now while we're talking.
Right now I am 11 years old.
11, okay. So it's been a while since you set out on this big adventure.
Yeah, a few years ago now.
Sure. Okay. What a cool story you have to tell about your life so far, and especially thinking about it as a 7-year-old, getting back and then from there through to now, you're an adventure walker and a published author by age 11. What do your schoolmates think of that?
Well, most of my friends think it's pretty cool to have a book when I'm only 11 and have shared and written it with my mum. And sometimes I go hiking with some of my friends, outdoor friends. So, yeah, they also think it's really cool.
Cool. Good stuff. If you had known how hard you would find walking the trail in places, do you think that you would have said yes so easily when your mum asked you if you'd do it with her?
think still I would say yes, because it's all part of the experience and adventure, because even if it's really difficult and hard at the time, it can make great stories to tell later.
Yeah, that's one of the things about tramping, isn't it? It's all about how good the story is afterwards, often, because at the time it can feel pretty hard, but it does make great stories, as you've shown here. You and your mum made this book together. How did that go? Tell me about what it was like working with her and who did what and how the writing happened, how the putting together it happened. Tell us how the story of the book.
So we went through a series of my diaries that I made. We were walking the TA,
mm-hmm.
and we put them together and chose some photos, and I did some drawings. And then my mum wrote it. And we put it all together to create a fabulous book.
Right. And did you get to edit the writing? Did you say, Mum, I wouldn't say that? Or how did the writing itself go? Did you feel like your mum got the storytelling part of it just right?
Yeah, I definitely think she got the storytelling bit just right. She had already written a book before that.
Yes.
Which seemed to be really good. So she's really good at writing adult books and children's books.
Good endorsement, Mum. So for listeners, I'm speaking with Emily and her mum, Victoria, together, even though Emily is the subject of our interview. Victoria, a great endorsement there from Emily for your writing. Have you got any more books in the planning, or are you planning any more together?
Yeah, absolutely. We are actually just putting together a draft manuscript for another book in Emily's voice. This time it's set in the rugged wilderness of southwest Tasmania, based off a 24-day epic hike that we did last summer.
Cool. That sounds...
So Emily's just been... Yeah, putting down all of her memories, and then we sort of combined that with details of route descriptions and, hoping very much to find an Australian publisher to take this one on.
Wow, Emily, that's it's such an exciting life that you lead with these big walking adventures. How do you fit it in around your schooling and the rest of your kind of day-to-day life? Is it feel easy to kind of move between your adventure self and then your kind of home-based self?
Yeah, so at the moment I'm being homeschooled.
Mm-hmm.
So that means we can pop out and go for trips anytime we want. But it has been a very wet spring, so trips can be limited where there's no rivers.
Sure.
But still, it's really nice to get out, and I'm glad we're down here so that we can go do some hiking.
Cool. You're eager to get back into the mountains whenever you can. That feels like it's part of your soul now as well.
Yeah, it's definitely been a big part of my life. And I think if I just left it behind, I'd feel quite empty, because it's definitely been something I've been into for quite a few years and done quite a lot.
Yeah. Wonderful. So some of the illustrations in the book are yours, obviously. There's lots of cool drawings. Are they ones that you made in your journal while you were walking, or are they retrospective? Did you do them to illustrate the book, or a bit of mix?
Well, some of them have been copied out of my original diaries, and most of them, pretty much all of them, are just drawn in an art pad.
Right. And now, as an 11-year-old, you still enjoy drawing as much as you did as a child? So is it still something that you love, or also thinking about journaling, is that something that you do as enjoy as much as you did when you were 7 and on the Te Araroa?
Yeah, I still really like drawing things. I like drawing whatever I can really draw. And yeah, I still keep tramping journals for when we go hiking as well.
Do you journal during your home life as much, or is it really just about recording your trips?
Normally I just do it on our trips.
Interesting. I think I was kind of intrigued by that, because the journaling's quite a grown-up kind of activity in lots of ways, thinking about your day and getting your thoughts straight about it and all that kind of thing. So I was intrigued to know whether how it was for you, or is it just about kind of like keeping a snapshot, or is it about working out how you think?
Well, with my diaries, I normally draw a picture of what we've done during the day, and then I write about how many kilometres we've walked, what the weather was like, how much I enjoyed it, the rugged terrain, and then I write something that we did.
But you also try to drop into a place, don't you?
Yeah. And then I also try to drop into a place, maybe in the morning or afternoon, look back on it or something like that.
Cool. That was something I wondered about whether you do with us. Mm-hmm. If I just asked you to try and think back and remember the days walking Te Arador, which is a few years ago now, although you've got a great record here, if you were to close your eyes and think about one of the absolute best moments that you could remember, what would that moment be? The first one that comes to your mind?
Definitely walking down 90 Mile Beach and getting an ice cream at the holiday park at the very end.
Okay. And so if we were with you in that moment back there, just as you're kind of just approaching town or you've just stopped and got your ice cream, whichever's the best moment from your point of view, if we were standing beside you, looking around us, what would we see?
Well, you would see a very long beach with the ocean and then the twinkling lights of the little town and some rolling green hills.
Right, because you arrived into Te Arador quite late. You kept walking, right? That was one of your longer days. Am I right thinking that?
Yeah, so that day was 30 kilometres and we arrived on dark at the campground.
Oh, my God, 30 kilometres is miles. And you're only 7 at this stage.
Yeah, but I really wanted an ice cream, and we had been walking on the beach for 6 days, and I was like, I'm going to walk all the way to the end. And I want an ice cream.
That's so cool. Hey, so do you think that this is something that any 7-year-old, if I look at those photos of you, I don't know, you seem maybe quite a strong kid, and you look like you've got quite long legs as a 7-year-old. I don't know whether that's just your mum's photo taking, but do you think any 7-year-old could set out and do the trail?
Yeah, anyone can do it. It's just about having, I guess, the right level of fitness and the momentum and the attitude, as well as the dedication and enthusiasm.
Yeah, and maybe the mum, do you think?
Yeah.
You talk about being each other's encouragement. And in that excerpt you read, the ways that your mum encouraged you are pretty obvious in that storytelling, just like keeping you engaged and keeping your mind enjoying the pleasures of everything that you're walking through. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about what you got out of it in terms of your relationship with your mum? How it made you feel with each other?
Well, it was really nice to be out of school for about 6 months and spending every day in the nature with my mum and not really seeing anyone for maybe days at a time, because I really liked hiking outdoors with her, and I still do, and it just was really nice to be together and tell stories and connect with the nature.
Yeah. You're great friends, eh? Did you have fights? Did you have times where you just really threw the toys out of the cot and got grumpy with each other? You should see the look on their faces, you two. They're both kind of...
Well, there was this one time when we were walking probably past the river, and I was talking about some dolls, because I've always had this thing because I really like dolls.
Yeah.
And I'd just been talking and talking and talking about them for probably hours on end. And my mum was like, Emily, sweetheart, do you think we could just stop talking about the dolls and talk about some birds instead? And my response was, well, I don't care about your stupid birds, and stormed off.
When I took my daughter tramping many, many years ago, and we tramped the St. James, which I think you would have come over the Waio Pass into the St. James. And one of the reasons that we'd chosen that was because my daughter was mad on wild horses. And so the whole of the first day of the St. James, before we saw the wild horses, we would talk. You couldn't shut her up, but talking only about horses, to the point where I had to leave her walking with somebody else because I just was like at my limit about horse chat. So I understand how you might get a bit tired of each other's singular focus on the story. You want to be a conservationist, I think, now when you grow up, or you did at the time that you were telling us the story of Te Araroa. Is that still your plan for your adult life?
Well, I would really like to be a marine biologist because I've got a passion for the ocean.
Right.
And I really like the ocean. I want to protect it as much as I want to protect our birds and forests and on land wild places.
Wow. Perhaps we're going to hear a sailing adventure or a kayak adventure from you at some stage in the future, Emily. That would be marvellous to follow you on another adventure. I look forward to reading about Tasmania. I'm sure many of our listeners do as well. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. The book is titled Emily Walks Te Araroa. It's published by Potten and Burton. It's a treat for Christmas stockings. And like many books, something for parents to enjoy with their kids. But this one will also hopefully inspire everyone to set out on some cool adventures together. Ngā mihi to you both.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.